It is my great pleasure to welcome here to Many Rivers for the first time, visiting from beautiful Madison, Wisconsin, Barbara Verkuijlen and Dale Verkuijlen. Mm-hmm. Barbara Verkuijlen is the author of this lovely book, The Tale of Zen Master Bo Li, which you, the bulk of our discussion tonight will be about. But in addition to that, she is the author of Dokusan with Dogen, Timeless Lessons in Negotiating the Way. And with Dale, they together have written Tending the Fire, an Introspective Guide to Zen Awakening. They're both Zen students of decades length and have studied with Katagiri Roshi, among others. The two of them have founded the Midwest Soto Zen Center in Madison, Wisconsin. And I am delighted to welcome Barbara and Dale Verkuijlen to Many Rivers Books and Tea. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. There's a radio program that's produced in Madison called the Best to the Best of Our Knowledge. Perhaps you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. When that first was started to being produced, there was a large questioning that program was produced in Madison, because usually there's nothing between the East Coast and the West Coast. The people think there's nothing in between.
Fly over.
Yeah. Long so it's a kind of strange. We've gotten, people have said, well, you know, people from Madison never come to the West Coast or the East Coast to, you know, to do anything like this. Usually it's people from the West Coast, the East Coast, where the creativity seems to be, you know, more manifest. Anyway, we're here.
Yay!
And we've been enjoying ourselves a great deal. We've had a great time. It's kind of nostalgic for me because I lived in California for 11 years, but haven't been back here too often. And so, especially coming up here to Santa Rosa, because I used to have a little sports car and I used to drive up here when I was young in the early 60s, you know, just traveling around. And it was a lot less people and a lot less cars at that time. Anyway, thank you for your welcome back here. We've been, as Rob has said, we've been students of Zen for over 40 years, and we practiced with a number of teachers. And then in the year 2000, we decided we needed to do something. And so we founded the Midwest Soto Zen community in Madison. And so we've got a couple of groups practicing out of that. And we started writing manuals for Buddhist training. And out of those manuals came some material that we've forged into study guides, but there have been some books that have come out of that. And two or three of them are here tonight on it. We decided we were going to publish them. So we started looking for a publisher, and we discovered, first off, if you're not a tier one author, you're in trouble trying to get somebody to listen to you. But even though there was some interest in the Tale of Zen Master Bo Li, the illustrated book, but we discovered that we would lose control of that book if we had somebody publish it. So we decided we'll start our own publishing company. And so we have this little publishing company in Madison where we have focusing on Zen literature alone, and we've got some essays on our website, and we have some study guides, and we have now, I think, six different books that we have, and we have five of them here tonight. Two of them are poetry books by an Iowa City, Iowa gentleman, a longtime Zen student as well, that he found when he was 72 that he couldn't stop himself from writing poetry. He wrote two books in less than 6 months, and he's just written another book of poetry in 1 month on it. The stuff he says, he sits down and it just pours out of him on it. It's really kind of a remarkable thing. And it's kind of something, because he's never written anything in Zen before he was in his 70s. He had written other books, but never been like that. But anyway, tonight, Barbara is going to do a presentation on the Tale of Zen Master Bo Li, and we have the these other books up here that you can glance through later if you care to. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. The Tale of Zen Master Boley originally was given as a talk on Zen to a group that Dale and I visited for once a month for a number of years. And some time during that period, I wanted to do something different than the usual presentation. That was back in 2002. So it's taken some time to evolve from that talk into this book. And the only reason it exists in its present form is because of Dale's persistence and patience. Over those years, he would encourage me from time to time to do something with that Boley story. And I had a lot of resistance to the idea, mainly that he knew the story needed illustrations, and the idea or the thought of finding the right artist just seemed daunting. Excuse me. I'm sorry, the incense is a little bit. Oh, thank you. So, but regarding the idea of doing something different, for that presentation I decided to write a fable because it was something fun to try. And the fable format appealed to me because readers or listeners suspend their disbelief more easily in a fable. In a fable, animals can talk, the narrator can have an ongoing relationship with a deceased Zen master, an old woman could be an immortal. And these mysteries don't need to be explained because when we enter a fable, we've already jumped realities and we allow it to take us to another place. Fables generally impart a lesson, and because they create their own reality, they sustain their meaning over time. Fables can be read on multiple levels. And there's the surface story, of course, but there can also be embedded meanings, of which I'll share a few with you. But regarding the surface story, the main idea was to put the whole human being back into the Zen master. Zen literature is full of the enigmatic accounts of the awakening experiences of ancient Zen masters, but those anecdotes don't give us a sense of the evolution of the individual. We get no sense of the excruciating effort that was made in the excavation of that person's existential dilemma, and the whole of the person's life has gone into that resolution. So the next thing that needed to be decided is, well, but what is a Zen master? So I have two quick stories to share that will perhaps give some understanding about what I had in mind for Master Boley's character. And the first regarding an interview I heard with the poet-songwriter Leonard Cohen after he left Mount Baldy Zen Center. He spent 5 years there studying with Master Suzaki. And during the interview, he was asked why he undertook the strenuous effort of Zen training at that time of his life. He was no longer young when he entered the monastery. And he replied, "Because I finally met a man who was comfortable with himself. If he'd been a German physicist, I would have gone to Germany and studied physics." Sounds very Leonard, doesn't it? Well, more recently, except in the last couple of months, I had the opportunity to watch a video of a concert Leonard Cohen gave in London after leaving Mount Baldy. And he needed to perform again because while he was at the monastery, his business manager had embezzled most of his money. So while I'm watching this 2-DVD recording of his concert, I'm just kind of stunned by him. And not just the music, which I've always enjoyed, but there was something about his presence. He was so gracious and charming and so at ease. And it struck me that I'm watching a man who's really comfortable with himself. It was the most crowded auditorium I've seen outside of an amphitheater outdoor presentation. So it was something to see. So from what I could observe, it looks like he found what he was looking for. The second story is a comment by a contemporary Korean Zen master. At a public talk, a man asked him, "What's the difference between you and me?" In other words, what makes you a Zen master? And he replied, "I correct my mistakes faster." He has other pithy ones that I won't go into now. But so the story of the main characters in the story are Master Boley, the little fire throat, the little bird here, So You Say, whom I will introduce you to in a few moments, Master Wu, the abbot of the Silent Thunder Monastery, and Boley's three chief but most problematic disciples, say what, no way, and why me? from each of whom he learns an important lesson. So the book starts with the illustration of, and a little explanation of this unusual relationship that the narrator has. Oh, one other thing. So the story tells the life of Boley from the time that he's 8, an orphan by natural disaster, till his death at 72. But in addition to that, there are two other purposeful aspects to the narration. And the first one is the narrator's relationship to Boley, and then the narrator's relationship to the reader. So it starts out with a little explanation of this unusual relationship, and then a little view of his home village. He's the youngest of 8 children, so he has 7 older brothers who tease him quite a bit. And here we have one of his older brothers sending him on a little wild goose chase. But because he's kind-hearted, he doesn't really follow the advice, which saves him later from this catastrophe that befalls the town. But because he remains good-hearted, his brothers think he's not very bright, mistakenly think he's not very bright. And then we have a tragedy. And this is where he's left. And for 3 days, he's in this little crevice of the mountain, thinking, how is he ever going to escape such an unkind fate? When one of my good friends saw this illustration, she said, oh, he's in a tough spot. But this is the Firethroat, who really becomes Boley's mentor for about 2 years. And with his help, he climbs up that little crevice and comes to this spot. Scrambling at last onto the path, he stopped to catch his breath and look around. The bright expanse of morning sky, azure blue and dotted with wispy sprays of white clouds tinged with lavender, stunned him. The short distance from the ledge below to the path changed everything, and he couldn't help but wonder, how does the whole world shift so completely from one moment to the next? And the path had been so close all that time. So Boley spends 2 years living with the animals of the forest or woodland, completely, just the non-human world of nature. And after about 2 years, the little Firethroat senses that he needs something else and goes and explores what needs to be next. And he encourages all the animals of the woodland to help him take Boley to the next phase of his life. So they travel several days higher up the mountain. And then there comes a night where the other animals go back to the woodlands, and it's just the Firethroat and Boley. It was just the two of them now, as they journeyed for hours beyond the place where the woodland friends had all spent the night. Suddenly the landscape changed. A small clearing had been hacked out of the wilderness. Tensions turned cartwheel in Boley's stomach when he sighted a small hut a short distance away. He crouched there, frozen, hidden by the trees of the wilderness surrounding the little dwelling. It was a humble structure, but sturdy and well-tended, with a newly thatched roof and a substantial garden, planted not just with vegetables, but beautiful flowers, too. The Firethroat flew toward it. Boley remained motionless. Now the Firethroat sang her lovely song with persistence until an old woman came out of the house to listen. And that was the first time Boley laid eyes on So You Say. Here, with your kind indulgence, I must digress for a moment. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, there are not many tales of great women in the annals of Zen literature that have come down to us thus far, although I'm sure there have been many. Of course, we could start with Mahabhachapati, the Buddha's aunt and stepmother, and Yasodhara, his wife, to name just two who were there from the beginning. But if you read voraciously enough from time to time, woven into the ancient stories, you will encounter a unique figure, an old woman who runs a tea house or an inn. In such tales, she has contact with various Zen fools and masters, and generally has a most influential impact on them. She's affectionately known in Zen lore as a dangerous granny. What makes a dangerous granny dangerous, you ask? Oh, she's not aggressive in the ways we fear from the world. then what's endangered by the presence of a dangerous granny? Strangely, it's our ignorance, our delusions, our self-importance, and consequently, our unhappiness. Now you may be thinking, why should we fear that? And that's a very good question. A dangerous granny is as old as the mountains. She usually lives alone and has been there since the oldest grandfather was a boy and remembers his grandfather's stories of her from when he was a child. She supports herself by tending a small garden and providing tea or lodging for travelers passing through, most of whom, by the time they meet her, have lost their way. Those living closest to a dangerous granny have little contact with her. She unnerves them in some way. The children think she may even be a witch. But in times of great need, people ratchet up their courage and pay her a visit, trading small portions of rice for wisdom. She never turns away anyone in need. And all this was more than true, for So You Say. So Boley spends 3 years with So You Say. And he has a little healing catharsis here from all the grief that he's experienced. And she has a very unique way of training him and testing him. And she frequently asks him, what is your question? Implying that one should have a question. And the meaning of this game, or what she's really asking, is, what path are you on, and where is it leading you? And one day he answers her in a way that indicates that he's ready for the next phase of his life. And she prepares him and takes him to meet Master Wu, abbot of the Silent Thunder Monastery. I'm sorry? One day, she hadn't asked him in a very long time, and he forgot about the game, and one day she startled him and said, what is your question? And in the past, he'd always prepare the next time, but he didn't have a question, but it popped up anyway, and he said, what does it really mean to be a human being? So he gets to the monastery, where he's hazed a little bit, like he was by his brothers, because he's the youngest one there, as he was the youngest one in his family. And eventually, he becomes Master Wu's only successor. And then, he inherits all the problems of being the abbot. And the problems with his three chief disciples are the overt lessons in the story. The first one would say what? Actually, he has to go to So You Say for help with all of these. And so for the first one, he tells her what the problem is. She never really answers him. And then just before he leaves, she gives him these enigmatic statements like Zen masters will do. And then he has to figure it out for himself. So he tells about the problem with say what. And just before he leaves, she says to him, pay attention to your intention. And eventually he figures out how that will solve the problem with say what. And then comes lumbering into the monastery, No Way. And he's kind of an older man than the other monks and kind of clumsy, and he's pretty disruptive. And so there's problems in the monastery, and Boley begins to resent the influence that he has on it. And so he goes to talk to So You Say. And what she tells him regarding No Way is, don't forget what you don't know. And then he investigates No Way's life. And then the final disciple is Wai Me. And Wai Me was Boley's only female disciple, and what a ruckus she caused when she asked for entrance to the monastery. And what he learns from the problem with Wai Me is no blame, only responsibility. And Wai Me is the first one to achieve her awakening, although the other two chief disciples do too. And the story goes through to his death with a little, the death poem, or the last thing that he says. It's traditional in Zen. There's even a book out called Graceful Exits, which is the last statements of Zen masters and other wise beings. And No Way goes to tell So You Say of his death. And then they have to decide how to carry on at the monastery, and it's decided that Say What will become the abbot, and No Way and Mai Me will travel like disciples of the Buddha did, the countryside, and just talking to the Dharma to anybody who's interested. But they're not too sad about that because they go back to the monastery twice a year for special ceremonies. And then it ends with So You Say. And as for So You Say, she spent less and less time on Li Mountain after Bo Li's passing. She continues to fulfill her bodhisattva vows, deferring entrance to nirvana until all beings realize their radiant Buddha nature. According to Master Bo Li, she now wanders the world, assuming any form necessary to bring healing and compassion to the human heart, tirelessly committed to easing the world's sorrow. Master Bo Li wants you to know she's always available to those in need. Watch for her when you are most troubled and confused. Please remember, though, she rarely addresses the matter directly and is apt to appear in a most unlikely disguise. So, the story is set in China long ago, because that's where the Zen tradition originated. And although his name is made up, part of his name is the same as the mountain he's supposed to be from. And one of the embedded meanings in the story is why he's from Li Mountain. Because Chinese masters generally have a mountain name, I wanted it to be the same. But why he's from Li Mountain, there is a famous, in our tradition, a famous Zen master from the 9th century named Tungshan Langchi. Langchi was his given name, and Tungshan refers to the mountain, and that's what he's known by. When Tungshan achieved his awakening experience, he wrote a poem called The Song of the Jewel Mirror Awareness. And in that poem, he references a hexagram from the I Ching. So the I Ching is a book of Chinese wisdom believed to be more than 5,000 years old, comprised of 64 hexagrams thought to offer counsel for any circumstance. Well, in Tungshan's poem, he references hexagram 30, Li, translated, it's the clinging, and its image is fire. And the message of hexagram 30 is, in difficult times, one should cling to the power of higher truth the way fire clings to the wood it burns. Higher truth is what offers clarity and is what should guide it. So the Li of his name in the mountain comes from that little inside information on Tungshan's poem. When Bo Li is young, he lives at the base of the mountain, and for every life-altering circumstance, he has to travel higher up the mountain. And how different would our view be from the top of the mountain compared to the base? One of the other embedded meanings of the story is the character of So You Say. In the lexicon of Buddhist terms, there's something known as prajnaparamita, perfect wisdom co-joined with compassion. And So You Say stands for that wisdom. She's the feminine principle of intuitive knowing that is necessary for discerning higher truths. And she's a mature woman because prajnaparamita is also known as the mother of all Buddhas. And she's immortal because truth can be obscured but not destroyed. Another important aspect of the story for me is how Bo Li deals with the problems. He's the abbot, and he has a good measure of authority, but he never misuses that as an abusive power to stifle resolution. Instead, he takes on responsibility for the problem and uses it to deepen and widen his understanding of what's really happening and tries to find answers that way. And the relationship between the narrator and Bo Li is a little subtler connotation. You know, what attitude should one take when undergoing the training of any subject with someone believed to be an authority in the field? Well, the narrator respects him and reflects on what he says, but she never relinquishes authority over herself to him. She thinks differently about certain things. She challenges him, and at times she even relates that he irritates her. But still, they maintain this relationship. So those are just a couple of the embedded meanings that I had the intention to do. But since writing this story, many, many more symbolic meanings have arisen for me, and I'm always curious about who put those in. And one of those is the fire throat, which is really an important character to the book. But I had just written him into a tight spot, and I tried to rewrite that several times, and it just wasn't going to happen. And it was like Bo Li's over here saying, no, that's my history now, and you don't get to do it over. You have to find a way out from here. So I looked. I thought, well, I guess a bird could come. And I looked up birds in China and was taken with the name and the description of the firethroat. But the firethroat means a lot more to me now. It's even why we call our endeavor Firethroat Press. One other way that the story that can be viewed, the whole fable can be viewed as the internal life of one individual. Boli stands for the individual. So you say is the internal teacher we all have. The problematic disciples are whatever obstructs us in our life. What keeps us from living freely and generously in the world? And then, of course, there's the fire throat. But if you read it, I'll let you decide for yourself what that is. One of the interesting things for me since writing the book is, well, as a writer, you know what your intention is. But it's become really clear to me now, because it's the first thing I had done, that that's only part of it. And it really is just what's more important is what the reader takes away from it. And one of the pleasant things is that I was surprised by how many people emailed me after they read the book. And very interestingly, the different takes that people had, the motivation for writing, had nothing to do with my intention of writing it. One woman wrote that everyone who helped Boli in his life was how God acts in the world. And another woman described herself as a Wiccan practitioner and said she loved the idea of the definition of a witch being a beneficent, dangerous granny. And a third woman, they're all women, said she was undertaking shamanic studies, and she understood Boli's relationship with the fire throat because in her shamanic journey she's being tutored by the spirit of a hawk. So that was very lovely to me to get those kinds of things and see where the story goes. I think because I just didn't expect that, because I thought because the environment was this Buddhist milieu that it would be limited to that. But I think that the Buddhism is just the background of the fable, and the lessons are applicable, you know, beyond that. It could be Planet Lulu, you know. It's just it happens to be in this monastery. I'd like to say one other thing, because someone mentioned something about the illustrations. The holdup was trying to figure out what kind of illustrations to have, and I really didn't know on it. But when I started looking around, I was on hours looking at artists' websites, and I wanted it to be close because I wanted to meet the person. I really wanted it to be a relationship and a collaboration and not just a business deal that I dealt with somebody from New Zealand by email, although we did a lot of email stuff. So when I found Aaron Gilmore's website, of all the various kinds of things that he had in his work, there was one illustration that was this style. And it did turn out to be a very nice collaboration. I think he's like 26 or 27 years old. It took 7 months to complete the illustrations. I decided what scenes I wanted illustrated, and I always had a few things specifically that I wanted in it. He always did them, but always in a way that I couldn't have imagined. So getting each illustration was like a great gift that helped the story come alive for me, like, oh, that's what his village looks like, and that kind of thing. So that was really fun. We did some presentations together in the Madison area, and it was only when we did those that I really understood how he did them. He did all of the in pencil first, and then when that was agreed upon, then he inked the whole drawing. Here's a little sample. So he actually did each illustration 3 times, just in the process itself. Then he would ink the whole illustration, and then he scanned that into his computer, and they're colored in Photoshop. So, I'm old. I go to sleep. I'm asleep by 9:30 some nights, and 10 o'clock if I'm up late. And so one day I looked at this email I got from him with one of the illustrations. It was like 2:30 in the morning. So, you know, and then when he became engaged, just towards the end of the process, and we went out to dinner to celebrate the book and their engagement. And I'm hoping I get an invitation to the wedding, but I'm not counting on that. But I miss him. It was fun. So that's the tale of Zen Master Boli, and I'll entertain any comments or questions you may have about this or anything else. Yes?
If I understood correctly, this was originally a talk you gave.
Yes.
Did you then craft it into a written form? Or was the talk...
The talk was pretty much written.
It was already...
It was this story that I had memorized in those days.
You had already created the characters.
Yes.
And the whole thing.
Yes. But mostly the characters came... I had kind of the characters' names and the three lessons that I wanted to put in the talk, and then kind of wove it around. I mean, it's more perfected than that first talk, but that was the whole thing was kind of there.
Did you take a lot of time to refine the written language at all?
Hundreds of hours. It's excruciating. I'm not like Joe Michaud, who's the poet. It doesn't just pour out. Yeah. And then found an editor, you know, that was helpful. And that was, you know, the whole publishing side was a steep learning curve for us. But we have a nice team now of an editor, an illustrator. Erin did all of the covers for the other books. And in Tending the Fire, there's a little section that's also illustrated. And he did those drawings also. And the person who designed it is the same person who had done all of them. So.
Is your illustrator interested in Zen?
He's not a practitioner, but he liked the story and, you know, had done some readings. He's connected to the story.
You know, as it turns out, his father is... He was a sword kendo practitioner, and he had been to Japan innumerable times. And so he had that kind of connection, because kendo and Zen are close together.
Yes, go on.
Another question. Is your audience for the book primarily adults? Or?
Thank you for asking. The book is kind of like an orphan, like the main character, because it's an illustrated book or picture book, and so you think children. But it's really not a children's story. You know, it's too long. The language isn't for children. I wrote it for practitioners, basically. It has been used in children's groups, though, Buddhist children's groups. I wouldn't do it with anyone younger than 10. But it could be a good teaching book because you can talk about, well, what is intention, and what do you mean, no blame, only responsibility? You know, those can be, and children would enjoy it. But, yes, thank you. It's not, you don't want to read it to a 5-year-old. They'll go. We had the opportunity and we took a trip in the spring, and we went to Great Tree Monastery in Asheville and Malaprops. And when we got to the monastery, the abbot there said, oh, one of the children just reviewed your books. His name was Ren, and he was 10. So I read the review, and it was just darling. It was just really charming. And the last line was something like, well, I guess adults could read this book and get something out of it. But to really understand this masterpiece, I think you should be a child. And I recommend 12 to 15, and he was only 10. I got a little gift for him and put it in a bag and thanked him for the wonderful review. And I gave it to the abbot. Well, then when we did the presentation at the bookstore, his father brought him there. So I got to meet him, and that was the highlight. It was just great. The best review. I mean, there were other good reviews, but I really liked it. But thank you for that question, because, yeah. And that's why on the back of the book, it doesn't say children's. It says Buddhism, Zen studies instead of children's. Anything else?
I have a question.
Yes.
So what did you get out of, right, first coming up with the talk,
mm-hmm.
and second, going through the process of writing the book, and what you get out of it now, relating it now, what is that for you?
That's a good question. You know, having the story for a long time, and there was a couple things that held up the story. One, the artist, and there were I was still working, and we were running around. We were doing our circuit riding, is what we call it, you know. 3 weekends out of every month, we were traveling, doing presentations or leading retreats somewhere, so energy was pretty low. And so when I wrote the book, 2002, a couple years later, with Dale's encouragement, I started to think about doing it again. And the tragedy is an earthquake and tsunami. And that was written before the Indonesian tsunami. And so that happened, and he went, oh, you know, I can't do this, you know, and I put the story away for a long time. And then just before, we found an American printer for this book. It was all done, the illustrations were done. You have that terrible tsunami in Japan. And my heart just sank, and he went, oh. But it was all in process. I don't know if that answers your question. So there's been a lot of different things with it. So the waiting, there's a satisfaction in having done it, but when this book was actually in hand from the printer, we were in the throes of the other two, and it was a momentary thing because we had to jump back into business. So it's just now that I'm experiencing some satisfaction about having it completed. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It answers the second part. The first part was what was it to you when you first, when it first arose as a talk to give? And was this a talk that you repeated in various
places? No, it was a talk I gave to one place. And it was specific to that place. The lessons were specific to that place.
Got it.
So we had been visiting this place, and there was some disturbance in the Sangha. It wasn't harmonious. It was an eclectic group of lay practitioners, and we were invited guests. And so it didn't feel appropriate to act in any other way, and so this was just a subtle way of saying, let's look at what's happening.
And did the message get through to the Sangha at the time?
The lessons, for a while, yeah. No, but it was what it was. That's why it was those lessons. Yeah. Did you have a question?
Well, I love the comment, because he's kind-hearted, his brothers think he isn't very bright.
But
I just love that. I wonder, I think I grew up with that myself. I thought that because I had this kind impulse, I thought that I wasn't strong enough to be mean.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I always associated it with a kind of a weakness. And culturally, I wonder, is it still common? It is still, because it was how I felt about myself,
yes,
too.
Yes. I'm sorry you had to carry that.
It was wonderful because it was a great challenge to turn that coin over and see the other side. And but I just wanted to give that issue a little bit more attention.
Anybody else want to comment on that? I think it is still part, you know, it's the highest, you know, activity, you know, to be kind.
Along with it, there came a determination to kind of prove that it was a higher calling, that it was actually smart.
Good.
It's interesting because I've been looking at a category of children's books for adults.
Oh.
I've been examining that.
Yeah, there's many, aren't there? There's many of them. Are there?
Oh, no, I've been writing them.
Oh, you've been writing them?
Yeah.
Oh, that's even better.
Since we still have a little time, could you talk a little bit about the other books?
Sure.
That you have?
Yeah. Sure.
Since you have several more.
Okay. Dokusan with Dogen and some other more traditional Dharma talks that I had given over the years. So there's 10 in here. They're not that traditional because I kind of range. Actually, my son read one of them and he goes, "Mom, you take people on a trip," you know. But I know where I want the destination to be. So it's not just typical Buddhist Dharma talks. It includes modern scientific findings, contemporary anecdotes and stuff. It's not just, it says Dokusan with Dogen. Dokusan means private encounter with a Zen master, and Dogen was a 13th century Zen master who founded the lineage that Dale and I practice. And so Dokusan with Dogen is, what can you learn from a master? You know, each essay starts with a quote from him, and then, you know, kind of evolves into how to understand that for a modern practitioner.
That book and the other book, The Tale of the Zen Master Bully, there's a common theme in that, Barbara. In both of them, she's dealing with a dead Zen master.
Yeah, what's the deal with that? Yeah,
well,
she points that out.
Them are dead, so
yeah, there's contemporary ones too, but it's like, okay, but they have
but
this
she's
relationship.
Having a conversation with
that's true. Yeah. Well, you want to talk about Tending the Fire?
Okay, yeah. This this other book, Tending the Fire, came out of, we've been practicing Zen, studying Zen with a number of people for 20 years, and I guess we were doing okay, we're feeling pretty good about things, but we still had, you know, instability and anxiety and issues in our life that were not being addressed. The tendencies were sometimes overwhelming. And at that time, Barbara came into contact with a man named David Grohl. He was a psychotherapist, and who had studied with Milton Erickson. Anyway, he had developed his own original means of approaching these issues, these stubborn issues, and they had some commonality with Zen practice. Actually, a deep commonality with Zen practice. And so Barbara recognized that right away. And then we started incorporating that into our practice and to address these deep-seated tendencies, which in Zen, the technical term for them, are conditioned states. And so we've worked 20 years with these conditioned states and developed a means that is harmonious with the teachings of Zen, particularly the non-duality teachings of Zen Master Dogen, and with David Grove's method on it, and combined them together. And Barbara mostly did the work, and we've come up with a means where we can work with these conditioned states directly, accurately, quickly. There's a section in Zen practice that sometimes is inhibiting because it's missing. There's a need for a real introspection of what these conditioned states are. You have to be able to know what they are before you can do something with them. And so we developed the means to know what they are and to deal with them on it. And that is essentially the sum of this book. It's Tending the Fire, an introspective guide to Zen awakening. One of the things that characterized this book is, can't help it, Barbara's strengths and my own predilections. And one of the things, and I'm an engineer, or was, for my working life, and so I deal with graphs and tables and charts and all that stuff. So what she wanted me to do was to create, you know, a symbol that could be encapsulate the teaching of non-duality, and then lay on top of that the teachings of this introspection.
And so, he did. And I said it as a joke. Well, why don't you just create a symbol for us? And he went downstairs, and a week later he came back.
And so there's a number of symbols that can be worked with. And once I got the original symbols, now you can take we can take other teachings in Zen and lay it on there, and you can lay other things like quantum mechanics, the quantum consciousness. You can lay that on the symbol too. So it's something that is in some ways universal. That's something to work with. Anyway, that's what this book is.
Can you see one? Or?
Pardon?
See one of the symbols? Or?
I'll see one of the symbols.
Yeah.
Very the engineer like it. You know, all arrows going in there.
There's some use for
good
us.
For you. So, what kind of condition states, for example? What's an example?
Well, for example, we have an example in that. Well, there's three or four or five different examples in that book, but one of them is in-depth look at one that a practitioner that we worked with had called trepidation. That was the, she had trepidation to move in the world, and that trepidation inhibited many things in her life. She couldn't move, and so that's the story of her release from that. That trepidation is in the book. And if you start looking at these things, you know, there's any different numbers of them.
Layers.
They have
it, we're like
layers.
An onion. Yeah. There's layers of it, but, you know, it's... But a conditioned state are the limiting tendencies we struggle against within ourselves. And they're frustrating because no amount of intellectual understanding about why we are the way we are seems to lessen the impact that they have on our life. They have to work directly with it and consciously to change the pattern determined by a conditioned state.
What constitutes working with the conditioned state?
That's the whole method. I mean, you can do it in it. This is one method for working with conditioned states, and we try to make it compatible with meditation. But people do body work, somatic emotional release, and all kinds of other kinds of things. But what makes it working with it is consciously working with it, being conscious of it as a conditioned state, and working with it through your awareness and your practice. And
one of the things in Zen, you know, Zen teachers, you say, just sit, be in the moment, and your problems will, you know, go on and they'll dissipate. And that's true if you have an awareness practice that's like a burning torch. That could happen, but for most of us, it's an impossible thing to achieve because of our life. We're lay people. We don't devote 100% of our time to it. We're scattered in many different places, and so this book is written for the lay practitioner so that they can use the force of the introspection. The introspective guide is two sections. One of them you work with the resolution of the conditioned state of, and working with the resolution of the conditioned state is knowing what it is, observing its function, inquiring into its nature, embracing what it is, achieving the resolution, and then having the psychophysical formation that the conditioned state's embedded in resolve itself. That is known as the deconstruction of the conditioned state. And then there is a reconstructive phase, which is the study of the freedom that you achieve by deconstructing. And there's another six steps that goes on with that. So it's kind of detailed on what it is and going on. And it's written, as Barbara said, as a skillful means, not the skillful means, but a skillful means.
An adjunct practice to traditional Zen practice. Did that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. I think the broader question is just in and around what, and I think you've already kind of covered it, what was not present in the Zen practice that you were trained in to resolve these kinds of states. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like from what I'm hearing from you is that the nature of our lives where we were subject to many distractions and a lot of fragmentation, mm-hmm. as opposed to being able to be focused in a monastic environment for an extended period of time, necessitates a different kind of approach for these kinds of factors.
Exactly. I'd just like to clarify condition state in one more way in this work. And the things that I learned through David Grove studying his work. The conditioned state is how we store the unresolved learning from a negative experience. It's charged negatively and it's stored somewhere in the body as a symptom. So that's the definition of it from the work in that book. So, and the unresolved experience is a subjectively experience. It doesn't have to be something extreme. You know, in childhood it can be the look in a parent's eye or the tone of a teacher's comment can create a conditioned state. Other things like an accident, a serious illness, a natural disaster, of course, could do it. But it's how we store negative learning from an unresolved experience. So that's how it's defined, what we're choosing to work with. Did you
want to
say something about that?
Yeah, we have two other books of poetry here, both written by the same author. He goes by his Buddhist name of Kyugen. His name is Joe Machaud, and these are the poems that are bubbling out of him as we speak. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the, so you can take a look at them.
Can you read one?
Sure.
Read your favorite.
Oh,
what?
You want to read one? Go ahead, find it.
Let me go here, but find out which one you want.
Two presents. Though the one present, the ephemeral, the other lies calm and clear outside of time, an eternal now, which posits no past and no future. We humans stand with one foot in a river of time, the other in an ocean of timelessness. We exist in time as if our names were written on water.
Yes, the first one in this book is called Lost Time, as we named it. Pass through presence into absence, upon return inquire into time lost. Where is it gone? Who is it that lost it? There is a place beyond space, there is a moment beyond time that cannot be measured. That particular one speaks to me because that's exactly the point of Zen practice. So,
thank you.
Well, thank you so much on behalf of Many Rivers. And I'm so glad that you could make it. And I have. Oh, first one.